Chapter 6. Invasion of France. Russia sides with France. England still neutral. Firing heard. The Emperor to take command. Paris, Thursday. No battle has been fought yet. But Field Marshal McMahon telegraphs thus to the Emperor. If the French army survives until Christmas, there'll be trouble. Fornins dispatched it would be sagacious, if the devil went the rounds of his establishment, to prepare for the occasion, and took the precaution, to warm up the Prussian department a bit agin the day. Mike. There is an enormous state of excitement here over news from the front to the effect that yesterday France and Prussia were simultaneously invaded by the two bodies of troops which lately assembled on the border. Both armies conducted their invasion secretly, and are now hunting around for each other on opposite sides of the border. Russia espouses the cause of France. She will bring 200,000 men to the field. England continues to remain neutral. Firing was heard yesterday in the direction of Blücherberg, and for a while the excitement was intense. However, the people reflected that the country in that direction is uninhabitable and impassable by anything but birds. They became quiet again. The Emperor sends his troops to the field with immense enthusiasm. He will lead them in person when they return. Fourth day the European War. No battle yet, the troops growing old. But bitter strife imminent. Prodigious excitement. The invasion successfully accomplished and the invader safe. Russia sides with both sides. England will fight both. London, Friday. No battle has been fought thus far, but a million impetuous soldiers are gritting their teeth at each other across the border, and the most serious fears entertained that, if they do not die of old age first, there will be bloodshed in this war yet. The prodigious patriotic excitement goes on. In Prussia, per Prussian telegrams, though contradicted from France. In France, per French telegrams, though contradicted from Prussia. The Prussian invasion of France was a magnificent success. The military failed to find the French, but made good their return to Prussia without the loss of a single man. The French invasion of Prussia is also demonstrated to have been a brilliant and successful achievement. The army failed to find the Prussians, but made good their return to the Vaterland without bloodshed, after having invaded as much as they wanted to. There is glorious news from Russia to the effect that she will side with both sides. Also from England, she will fight both sides. London, Thursday evening. I rushed over too soon. I shall return home on Tuesday's steamer and wait until the war begins. M.T. The Wild Man interviewed from the Buffalo Express, September 18, 1869. There has been so much talk about the mysterious ill man out there in the West for some time, that I finally felt it was my duty to go out and interview him. There was something peculiarly and touchingly romantic about the creature and his strange actions, according to the newspaper reports. He was represented as being hairy, long-armed, and of great strength and stature, ugly and cumbrous, avoiding men, but appearing suddenly and unexpectedly to women and children, going armed with a club, but never molesting any creature, except sheep, or other prey, fond of eating and drinking, and not particular about the quality, quantity, or character of the beverages and edibles, living in the woods like a wild beast, but never angry, moaning, and sometimes howling, but never uttering articulate sounds. Such was L.D. Shep as the papers painted him. I felt that the story of his life must be a sad one, a story of suffering, disappointment, and exile, a story of man's inhumanity to man in some shape or other, and I longed to persuade the secret from him. Since you say you are a member of the press, said the Wild Man, I am willing to tell you all you wish to know. By and by you will comprehend why it is that I wish to unbosom myself to a newspaper man, when I have so studiously avoided conversation with other people. I will now unfold my strange story. I was born with the world we live upon, almost. I am the son of Cain. What? I was present when the flood was announced. Which? I am the father of the wandering Jew. Sir? I moved out of range of his club, and went on taking notes, but keeping a wary eye on him all the while. He smiled a melancholy smile and resumed. When I glance back over the dreary waste of ages, I see many a glimmering and mark that is familiar to my memory. And oh, the leagues I have traveled, the things I have seen, the events I have helped to emphasize. I was at the assassination of Caesar. I marched upon Mecca with Mahomet. I was in the Crusades, and stood with Godfrey, when he planted the banner of the cross on the battlements of Jerusalem. One moment, please. Have you given these items to any other journal? Silence. I was in the Pinta's shrouds with Columbus, when America burst upon his vision. I saw Charles I beheaded. I was in London, when the gunpowder plot was discovered. I was present at the trial of Warren Hastings. I was on American soil, when the Battle of Lexington was fought, when the Declaration was promulgated, when Cornwallis surrendered, when Washington died. I entered Paris with Napoleon after Elba. I was present when you mounted your guns, and manned your fleets for the War of 1812, when the South fired upon Sumter, when Richmond fell, when the President's life was taken. In all the ages I have helped to celebrate the triumphs of genius, the achievements of arms, the havoc of storm, fire, pestilence, famine. Your career has been a stirring one. Might I ask how you came to locate in these dull Kansas woods, when you have been so accustomed to excitement during what I might term so protracted a period, not to put too fine a point on it? Listen. Once I was the honored servitor of the noble, and illustrious, here he heaved a sigh, and passed his hairy hand across his eyes, but in these degenerate days I am become the slave of quack doctors and newspapers. I am driven from pillar to post, and hurried up and down, sometimes with stencil plate and paste brush to defile the fences with cabalistic legends, and sometimes in grotesque and extravagant character at the behest of some driving journal. I attended to that Ocean Bank robbery some weeks ago, when I was hardly rested from finishing up the powwow about the completion of the Pacific Railroad. Immediately I was spirited off to do an atrocious murder for the benefit of the New York papers, next to attend the wedding of a patriarchal millionaire, next to raise a hurrah about the great boat race, and then, just when I had begun to hope that my old bones would have a rest, I am bundled off to this howling wilderness to strip, and gibber, and be ugly and hairy, and pull down fences and waylay sheep, and waltz around with a club, and play wild man generally, and all to gratify the whim of a bedlam of crazy newspaper scribblers. From one end of the continent to the other, I am described as a gorilla, with a sort of human seeming about me, and all to gratify this quill-driving scum of the earth. Poor old carpetbagger! I have been served infamously, often, in modern and semi-modern times. I have been compelled by base men to create fraudulent history, and to perpetrate all sorts of humbugs. I wrote those crazy Junius letters, I moped in a French dungeon for 15 years, and wore a ridiculous iron mask, I poked around your northern forests, among your vagabond Indians, a solemn French idiot, personating the ghost of a dead dauphin, that the gaping world might wonder, if we had a bourbon among uses. I have played sea serpent off Nahant, and woolly horse, and what is it for the museums? I have interviewed politicians for the Sun, worked up all manner of miracles for the Herald, ciphered up election returns for the World, and thundered political economy through the Tribune. I have done all the extravagant things that the wildest invention could contrive, and done them well, and this is my reward, playing wild man in Kansas without a shirt. Mysterious being, a light dawns vaguely upon me, it grows apace, what is your name? Sensation. Hence, horrible shape. It spoke again. Oh pitiless fate, my destiny hounds me once more. I am called. I go. Alas, is there no rest for me? In a moment the wild man's features seemed to soften and refine, and his form to assume a more human grace and symmetry. His club changed to a spade, and he shouldered it and started away sighing profoundly and shedding tears. Wither, poor shade. To dig up the Byron family. Such was the response, that floated back upon the wind as the sad spirit shook its ringlets to the breeze, flourished its shovel aloft, and disappeared beyond the brow of the hill. All of which is in strict accordance with the facts. M.T. Last Words of Great Men, from the Buffalo Express, September 11, 1889. Marshal Neal's last words were colon l'armée francaise. The French army. Exchange. What a sad thing it is to see a man close a grand career with a plagiarism in his mouth. Napoleon's last words were colon tête d'armée. Head of the army. Neither of those remarks amounts to anything as last words, and reflect little credit upon the utterers. A distinguished man should be as particular about his last words as he is about his last breath. He should write them out on a slip of paper, and take the judgment of his friends on them. He should never leave such a thing to the last hour of his life, and trust to an intellectual spirit at the last moment, to enable him to say something smart with his latest gasp and launch into eternity with grandeur. No, a man is apt to be too much fagged and exhausted, both in body and mind, at such a time, to be reliable, and maybe the very thing he wants to say, he cannot think of to save him. And besides there are his weeping friends bothering around, and worse than all as likely as not he may have to deliver his last gasp, before he is expecting to. A man cannot always expect to think of a natty thing, to say under such circumstances, and so it is pure egotistic ostentation to put it off. There is hardly a case on record, where a man came to his last moment unprepared, and said a good thing, hardly a case, where a man trusted to that last moment, and did not make a solemn botch of it, and go out of the world feeling absurd. Now there was Daniel Webster. Nobody could tell him anything. He was not afraid. He could do something neat when the time came. And how did it turn out? Why, his will had to be fixed over, and then all the relations came, and first one thing, and then another interfered, till at last he only had a chance to say, I still live, and up he went. Of course he didn't still live, because he died, and so he might as well have kept his last words to himself, as to have gone and made such a failure of it as that. A week before that 15 minutes of calm reflection would have enabled that man to contrive some last words, that would have been a credit to himself, and a comfort to his family for generations to come. And there was John Quincy Adams. Relying on his splendid abilities and his coolness in emergencies, he trusted to a happy hit at the last moment to carry him through, and what was the result? Death smote him in the House of Representatives, and he observed, casually, this is the last of Earth. The last of Earth? Why, the last of Earth, when there was so much more left? If he had said it was the last rose of summer, or the last run of shad, it would have had as much point in it. What he meant to say was, Adam was the first and Adams is the last of Earth, but he put it off a trifle too long, and so he had to go with that unmeaning observation on his lips. And there we have Napoleon's tête d'armée. That don't mean anything. Taken by itself, head of the army is no more important than head of the police. And yet that was a man who could have said a good thing, if he had barred out the doctor, and studied over it a while. Marshal Neal, with half a century at his disposal, could not dash off anything better in his last moments than a poor plagiarism of another man's words, which were not worth plagiarizing in the first place. He French army. Perfectly irrelevant, perfectly flat, utterly pointless. But if he had closed one eye significantly, and said, the subscriber has made it lively for the French army, and then thrown a little of the comic into his last gasp, it would have been a thing, to remember with satisfaction all the rest of his life. I do wish our great men would quit saying these flat things just at the moment they die. Let us have their next dash to the last words for a while, and see if we cannot patch up from them something that will be more satisfactory. The public does not wish to be outraged in this way all the time. But when we come to call to mind the last words of parties who took the trouble to make the proper preparation for the occasion, we immediately notice a happy difference in the result. There was Chesterfield. Lord Chesterfield had labored all his life to build up the most shining reputation for affability and elegance of speech and manners the world has ever seen. And could you suppose he failed to appreciate the efficiency of characteristic last words in the matter of seizing the successfully driven nail of such a reputation? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.